Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Well, over the holiday weekend here in the United States, the North Korean regime of Kim Jong-un detonated a very large device underground. There is some question as to what it was, a large perhaps pumped weapon or a thermonuclear weapon, as they claim, and what in turn that could mean if they're able to place it aboard some sort of delivery system, perhaps a ballistic missile, a satellite, who knows. To talk about all of this, I'm very pleased to say we have with us one of the country's preeminent authorities about matters involving nuclear weapons, who has them, how many, and what it means for our security, as well as what we need to have in the way of a credible deterrent to nuclear attack. He is Dr. Mark Schneider. For many years, he was the go-to man in the Defense Department and elsewhere in the U.S. government on matters involving these subjects and arms control. I've been privileged to know him and work with him for decades and always want his counsel on these issues as they develop and as we need to make sense of them. Mark is these days a senior fellow with the National Institute for Public Policy and a very important contributor to our understanding of what we're facing in the way of a very dynamic nuclear threat, not just from the North Koreans, by the way, folks, but the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, and others. Mark Schneider, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Let me ask you about, first and foremost, what was this weapon, as best you can tell, Mark? A hydrogen bomb or something else?
I think the odds are 99.9%. It was a hydrogen or thermonuclear weapon. It had a very large yield. Most of the press reports are saying 100,000 tons of TNT, but that could very well turn out to be a massive understatement of the actual yield. It comes out of South Korea, attributed to their military. They have a history of underestimating yields compared to probably the best work in the United States by the Los Alamos Nuclear or National Laboratory.
But our team has not yet been heard from on this, I take it. Is that right?
I haven't seen anything, and it takes some time to do.
And Mark, to the extent that it was on the order of 100 kilotons, or perhaps considerably more, that would make it a very large underground nuclear explosion, would it not?
Yes, particularly if it's a lot more than 100 kilotons, which is my guess based on the limited information we've got available. We won't know for sure, I think, until the Los Alamos people come in.
When you see this kind of explosion, is it your expectation that there will be some kind of venting or a crater that would ensure that radioactive gases, if not particulate matter, escapes, and that would almost certainly give us a fairly precise characterization of what kind of weapon it was and its size?
The North Koreans obviously don't have a lot of money to do the type of stemming that can prevent ventings. My guess is that there was a significant venting, but we won't know for sure until there's efforts at collection. Unfortunately, the Obama administration drastically cut funding for the program, AFTAC it's called, that does this type of collection. So that may be a factor as well.
This is another example of how unhelpful the Obama administration has been in all of these areas. I think that their what they called strategic patience contributed materially to the acceleration of this project by the North Koreans and the threat that we're now facing from it. One manifestation of that, we're being told now, Mark Schneider, is the possibility that the North Koreans would use one of these, some sort of nuclear weapon against us in what they call an electromagnetic pulse attack. Do you credit that as a real threat? And should we be taking it seriously, given the vulnerabilities of our electric grid to such an attack?
So the Kim regime is probably the most irresponsible government on the planet right now. So you've got to take the possibility of them going to war and using nuclear weapons, including EMP weapons and chemical and biological, for that matter, very seriously. We have done virtually nothing since the Electromagnetic Pulse Commission report, which exposed how vulnerable we are to this type of attack. Well, nothing is an exaggeration, but not much. We've done very little to improve our situation, and it got even worse under the Obama administration, who did virtually nothing. We have a very significant vulnerability here. At the same time, they cut funding significantly for missile defense that could prevent that type of attack. They killed some of our most important programs, including the boost phase interceptor, which would probably have been operational now and could have done an early intercept of a North Korean missile launch. And they cut funding of the most important program involving the type of interceptors we have now, the multiple kill vehicles. And they didn't revive that program until very, very late in the Obama administration. So we don't have it now.
So we are very exposed.
We are exposed. We have some defensive capability, but not nearly enough. And it's not multi-layered. Because of the cuts of the Obama administration in the missile defense program.
There is some talk, and again, our guest is Dr. Mark Schneider with the National Institute for Public Policy. He is a longtime leading authority, corporate memory, in particularly the Defense Department of the United States on these sorts of matters. Mark, let me ask you about one other aspect of the response to all of this so far. There is some talk about returning U.S. tactical nuclear weapons to South Korea. I don't know that the government of South Korea, a left-wing government at the moment, has any interest in that, but there is some speculation about this, to enhance deterrence of this sort of threat from the North. Could you talk a little bit about what we actually have these days in the way of credible and reliable tactical nuclear capabilities?
Unfortunately, very little. Almost the entire U.S. tactical nuclear capability has been eliminated since 1991. We are down to only a single type of gravity bomb carried by F-15s and F-16s. South Korean government has said that none of those are deployed in South Korea. We're at this point, I think this is one of the most important issues for the nuclear posture review. Are we going to stay with this type of posture, which I think is grossly inadequate in light of the threat we face both in Europe and in the Far East, both from the Chinese and the North Koreans? Or are we going to do something about it and revive some capability we should have never eliminated? The only piece of good news, and this is pretty recent, is that there's a report in Air Force Magazine that the Air Force has accelerated the deployment date for the B-61 Mark 12, the improved version of the B-61 bomb on the F-35 fighter, to the early 2020s. It had previously slipped to 2025. That's a good development, but it's not enough.
Well, and it's not very soon, that's for sure. It's nowhere near as close at hand as we need it to be at the moment. Mark Schneider, there's much more to talk about, particularly concerning the rest of the U.S. Strategic deterrent at a time when the Secretary of Defense, not just the President, is talking about some particularly aggressive kinds of responses, annihilation is the term he used today, about these threats. So it is particularly important that we understand the larger complexion of the U.S. strategic deterrent, as well as the inadequacies of our tactical nuclear weapons. We look forward to visiting with you about all of that in the near future. In the meantime, thank you so much for the tremendously important work you and your colleagues do at the National Institute for Public Policy. Come back to us again very soon, if you would.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined by Gordon Chang, our indispensable duty expert on matters involving Asia and U.S. interests in the region, as well as increasingly here, notably the threat that is emerging from North Korea. Gordon Chang, of course, is also prominently featured these days at the Daily Beast, Forbes.com, World Affairs Journal, Fox News. His books include The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown North Korea Takes on the World, a book that has never been more timely than at the moment. Gordon Chang, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thanks so much, Frank.
So over the weekend, as you know, the North Koreans not only detonated a very large weapon underground, by some accounts, it might just be what they claim, a thermonuclear H-bomb. But in any event, they've coupled it with a very explicit threat of something we've talked about in a somewhat speculative manner until now, a use of electromagnetic pulse to take down the American electric grid. Gordon, give us your reading on where we are now and the prospect that there may be another ICBM launch from North Korea in the offing any day now.
Yeah. The North Koreans are moving a mobile missile to their west coast. They're doing it at night so that we can't observe it as well as we otherwise might. I suspect, Frank, that they're going to fire a three-stage missile. We know that they showed the KN-08 on April 15th, 2012 in the Great Military Parade. They have not tested it yet. But we know from Bruce Bechtel of Angelo State University, who is one of the keenest observers of North Korea's military, that the North Koreans never show something that they don't eventually test or have already tested. The KN-08, I think, is perhaps the next thing to go. We've got to also remember that in July, there were two intercontinental ballistic missile tests. Those were both two-stage missiles, the Hwasong-14. They've got to test their three-stage missile to hold us at risk. And so I think that that's going to be the next thing up.
Now, Gordon, this has precipitated a considerably heightened sense of concern in Washington. It had been building for some time. You now have even the Secretary of Defense, who was somewhat, if not actually contradicting President Trump on some of his expressions of determination to deal with the North Korean threat, certainly lowballing their implications. We're now hearing him say as well that this is an environment that could well require a U.S. military operation to address. Do you have a sense that this thing is now lurching towards an actual conflict, perhaps of the nuclear kind?
Well, the risk of war is unacceptably high. We heard Secretary Mattis issue a deterrence warning to North Korea. And next to him, of course, was General Joseph Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That's an indication that the United States wants North Korea to know that it is not going to tolerate threats toward American territory. And as Mattis said, that includes Guam as well. It's necessary to do this because the North Koreans may misunderstand the United States, may miscalculate. And so it's important for Mattis to have delivered this warning.
To firm up, indeed. Gordon Chang, let me ask you about the hardy perennial in all of these conversations, and that is that we must engage China more effectively than we have to date. I was really struck this morning on National Public Radio Max Baucus, former United States Senator and Ambassador to China, actually said that during his time in Beijing, the Obama administration, quote, didn't know what it was doing, unquote, with respect to China and the North Korean threat. I'm willing to stipulate to that, but it is sort of extraordinary to have the man who presided over such dealings acknowledge it. But this is just one example, Gordon Chang, I don't need to tell you, of sort of the continuing hash-up successive administrations have made of this portfolio. Where are we with respect to China in all of this as you see it now?
I think the most important thing that we have seen recently is President Trump's tweet on Sunday that the United States was considering stopping trade with all countries that do business with North Korea. Many people thought that this was an isolated tweet, unconnected to policy, but that is wrong because just a few hours afterwards, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin said that he was going to draft a sanctions package to implement President Trump's tweet. And indeed, on Monday, our ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, mentioned this at the emergency meeting of the Security Council. This is going to be U.S. policy. Our policy with regard to North Korea is going to affect our trading relations with China, as indeed they should. And this is a very good step on the part of the Trump administration to view China as our policy with regard to China in connection with North Korea.
Gordon, let me ask you to do a little crystal ball gazing. A particularly chilling thought is one that is being bruited about by some strategic analysts, including, I believe, Jeff Nyquist, to the effect that this is really a trap for us, that the Chinese and Russians would pounce were we to take any action against the North Koreans. They're kind of spoiling for a fight. They may well be far better equipped to contend with us, particularly jointly, than we would be to deal with such threats. Do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, I think that we have to be very concerned that especially the Chinese would aid the North Koreans if there were to be a war. We have to just go back to 1950, where we ignored Chinese warnings that they would aid the North Koreans. And indeed, the Global Times, in an unofficial but I think authoritative editorial, said that China would come to North Korea's aid if the United States, without provocation in China's view, actually attacked the North. So when we talk about a nuclear exchange with the North Koreans, we have to be concerned that the Chinese are going to be on the other side of that. And as you point out, the Russians also could very well be a combatant in a future hostilities, largely because China and Russia are coordinating their foreign policies across the board, but also on North Korea as well.
Yeah, ominous, ominous developments. Gordon, very quickly, let me ask you about one other development. You have long been speculating that the Indians may be a counterweight to the Chinese in all of this. They've had strained relations, of course, for decades. Yet there was a meeting over the weekend, I believe, between the president of China, Xi Jinping, and the prime minister of India, Narendra Modi. What do you think came of that, and what does it portend?
I think that there was very little that will come out of the meeting between Prime Minister Modi and Chinese President Xi Jinping. This was part of the so-called BRICS summit. BRICS is the acronym for developing countries, specifically Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Modi has always made it clear that he was going to, at least on the surface, maintain cordial relations with his Chinese counterpart. But the Indian policies have certainly been much more difficult, as the Chinese would look at it. And especially Modi was very resolute in dealing with the Chinese incursion into Bhutanese territory, as well as Chinese incursions directly into Indian-controlled territory. I don't think we have to worry about these cordial meetings that Modi has with Xi Jinping. They've occurred all the time, and they don't seem to have very much effect on India's policy with regard to China.
We'll follow it closely, as will you. In fact, we'll do it with your beneficial help. Thank you so much, Gordon Chang, as always. Keep up the good work, my friend, at the Daily Beast and elsewhere. Come back to us next week. Next up, Kevin Freeman joins us. We'll talk about EMP in North Korea and economic warfare and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Kevin Freeman, our senior fellow for economic warfare-related matters, a subject in which he is quite expert. Indeed, he is the author of globaleconomicwarfare.com, an invaluable website addressing these sorts of issues. Also, the author of Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again. And of particular and very urgent relevance, Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. Kevin Freeman, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
I wanted to ask you, because you've spent a lot of time thinking about and writing on the threat of electromagnetic pulse, Kevin, and of course, as we've been discussing in the previous segments, North Korea has over the weekend declared that it is prepared to engage in an EMP attack against this country, perhaps using what seems to be an H-bomb, a thermonuclear weapon. Kevin, give us, if you would, your current assessment of our vulnerabilities to such an attack and the imperative of preventing it.
Well, thanks, Frank. Yes, you've been talking about the risk of EMP, and you've been talking about the risk of North Korea for a while. I covered it in my book, and yet it was dismissed repeatedly. The North Koreans, they're not advanced enough, they're not threatening enough. All of those seem to have been handily dismissed by reality over the weekend when they exploded what appears to be a hydrogen bomb. And in doing so, the Chinese are upset because this rankles global markets. It rankles, you know, it shows them to be less effective in any ability to rein in North Korea. It shows that they're willing to go against their Chinese masters, as they've been called. And then the immediate threat, very publicly, we'll use for an EMP if we want to. They just dismissed all of the naysayers, and it's just proven what you've said for at least a dozen years that I've known to be accurate.
I just as soon have been wrong about this, to be honest with you, and I'm appreciative of you calling to mind the history here, but it is one of these things that we should have addressed a long time ago, and we can't afford to tarry about any longer. A point that I believe, Kevin, was underscored by the effects of Hurricane Harvey in your native state of Texas. I wanted you to talk a little bit about some of the insights that we've had when the power has gone out in Houston and some of the surrounding communities as a result of that terrible storm, and what it really should teach us about the imperative of making the grid more resilient without further delay.
Well, this is another lesson from Mother Nature, so to speak, that how vulnerable our power grid is and how vulnerable modern society is to a lack of power. I mean, you could go back to the tsunami that hit Japan and the Fukushima nuclear problems they had wasn't because the water. It was because they ran out of power. And we've seen the similar things in Houston with chemical plants that require power for cooling of chemicals. And if you can't cool them, they explode. I saw here in Dallas-Fort Worth area, the impact is that we had gas stations that were silent, not because of a lack of power, but because of a lack of gasoline. But the effect is the same. Without power, you can't pump gasoline out of gas stations, which means you don't have transportation, which means you have food shortages. You know, it just leads, one thing leads to another to another. That is the underlying critical infrastructure.
It is indeed. And Kevin Freeman, one other lesson of Harvey was with respect to the oil infrastructure of this country, the energy infrastructure more generally as well. Of course, you mentioned disruption of supply in your own hometown. There have been price spikes, if not actual unavailability of gasoline elsewhere around the country. I'm also reminded of something else that we've been discussing and worrying about, and that is if Mother Nature could take offline refineries with ripple effects through our economy, what about having hostile powers, or potentially hostile powers at the very least, like Saudi Arabia and Russia owning some of those refineries
and choosing, should they decide to do so, to take them offline. Would that cause similar kinds of dislocation and disruption? And should we allow them to own such facilities?
Well, absolutely, it would cause that. They could. They would have the ability to take refineries offline if they chose. And we might have to go in and nationalize the refineries, which would take away some of America's claim to morality in the world. You know, we don't nationalize industries. But they could do that, or terrorists could sneak in and blow them up. I mean, we are very, very vulnerable to the energy infrastructure of the country. So there's no doubt. And having Saudi Arabia or the Russians controlling a huge chunk of our refining capacity, as is the case from what's happened in Venezuela and elsewhere, it puts us at serious risk. We become vulnerable to the whims of foreign dictators.
Kevin, I want to switch gears with you. We've been talking with several of our guests in this program about threats to freedom of speech. You had a terrific post on that subject at globaleconomicwarfare.com. Would you talk about it as a domestic problem in this country at the moment?
Well, I started digging into this with the SPLC designation of hate groups and so forth.
The Southern Poverty Law Center, one of my least favorite organizations, yes.
With good reason, right? And George Soros and Media Matters, someone else who's blatantly attacked you, according to WikiLeaks. And I'd started to dig into it because I'm very concerned that any contrary speech is considered hate speech and therefore forbidden. And I remember being in entering college in 1978 when the ACLU was demanding that the Nazis have the right to march in Skokie, Illinois. And I thought, what has happened on our campuses? What's happened particularly with the internet? We're seeing the systematic removal of free speech protections across media, entertainment, newspapers and reporting, internet. And this is a real threat to the American way of life, because these things can be funded by external sources. We saw the Southern Poverty Law Group have millions and millions of dollars offshore. We've seen that. That's been reported. Well, how do we know that they're not taking foreign contributions? How do we know that the Russians aren't using that as a means to influence? If you could target a hate group that goes against Russian policy, you could influence American politics.
Well, the Russians or for that matter, various countries espousing Islamism and seeking to shut down any discussion of what they're up to, the Muslim Brotherhood among them. I mean, these are very real concerns, Kevin, and you've gone through and you've talked about a number of ways in which this is manifesting itself. But I did want you to just take a moment to talk about the practice of shaming and how it fits into these sort of techniques for the purposes of silencing political opposition.
Well, I first heard this from Steve Coughlin, our mutual friend, who pointed out that the former Secretary of State Clinton, at a speech, I think it was at the United Nations, said, well, we have this pesky thing called the First Amendment, but we have the ability to shame people into activity and to stop activity we don't like by shaming it. And then I've watched it play out. He shared it with me. This is a horrifying ability to make someone feel stupid because they take a position that they've long held. So a Christian has long held that marriage is between one man and one woman, and well, you should be ashamed of yourself. You're Islam or you're a homophobe. Or if you happen to believe that women should be free to wear whatever they want to and in public and should be able to have all the benefits afforded by the Constitution and family law and so forth, well, then you're an Islamophobe. Or if you say that all lives matter, you're automatically a racist. And these are shaming techniques used to achieve specific political goals.
And specifically, those goals are to silence us. And what worries me particularly, Kevin Freeman, is we've been subjected to this, as you said, for essentially pointing out what is being done covertly, stealthily in this country, notably by the Sharia supremacists doing business as the Muslim Brotherhood, is to essentially enable them to get away with their covert, or as they call it, civilization jihad. It's a very, very important form of political warfare, and we appreciate you diagnosing it so powerfully at globaleconomicwarfare.com. I hope you'll come back to us with more insights on all of this next week. In the meantime, Kevin Freeman, thank you very much for your leadership in so many areas. Keep it up. We'll talk next with Michel Garfinkel about some of those efforts to shame us into silence as evidence in his native France and more generally in Europe and what it might mean for us. That more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Michel Garfinkel. He is a leading light in the freedom fighting world in Europe. He is the founder and president of the Jean-Jacques Rousseau Institute, a conservative think tank there. He's also a Shulman Ginsberg Fellow at the Middle East Forum on this side of the pond. Among other things, he has been the editor-in-chief of Valeur Actuelle, a conservative news weekly in Paris. He is always a welcome guest here. We're not often able to catch up with him, frankly, as often as I'd like, but we're delighted to welcome him back. Michel, thanks so much for taking a few minutes.
My pleasure, really.
We are following closely some of the reporting that you have been doing on what seems to be an upsurge in Europe of, I think of it as submission to the agenda of Sharia supremacists, whether it's manifested as sort of intensifying anti-Semitism or the imposition of so-called hate speech laws, which are pretty thinly masqueraded examples of Sharia blasphemy restrictions. Talk, if you would, about these things as you see them playing out in your own country of France and more generally in Europe.
Well, it's very difficult to deny that such a thing is actually occurring in France and in many other European countries. What we have is a feeling that you can criticize or deconstruct everything in Western civilization, Western democracy, but you are forbidden to make any critical observation regarding immigration and regarding especially Muslim immigration and the tendency among many of the Muslim immigrants to superimpose their own values, their own civilization, and their own religion to what we have in Europe in terms of civilization, religion, or ethical values. This is something which started as mere political correctness and has gradually developed into something much more ominous. There are different, certainly different ways of putting that problem in France and in other countries. The French, for instance, have been very concerned about what they called laïcité, the secular separation between church and state. In other countries, you may have a different way to raise the question of the survival of the Western values in front of, for instance, Islamist values. Let me give you a very graphic instance, One of the major features of social and political life in Europe and in France over the past 50 years has been feminism. It has been the growth of women's rights from just equality, which is certainly a very respectable idea, to something more awkward known as parity, which means that you must have an equal number of quotas of men and women in any position and in any venue of in French society. And strangely enough, the same people who for so many years have said that feminism is the accomplishment, really, of human rights in Europe now are getting all of a sudden incredibly tolerant of the Islamic view of women rights, which is simply the negation of rights for women.
Yeah, it's not equality, let alone parity, is it? Let me ask you, Michelle Garfinkel, because this really cuts to the heart of it. There is, according to The Economist, a hardening of attitudes in Europe against Islam. And yet, as you suggested, there is an awful lot of this kind of accommodation, appeasement, submission going on as well. Is it in fact a symptom of why these attitudes are hardening and a sort of catalyst for it when they see people abandoning basically French culture, French traditions, French values, and those more generally associated with Western civilization?
There is a growing concern all over Europe, and especially in France, about these developments regarding Islam and the rise of Islamic values versus classic Western and democratic values. Now, the problem is that the political class and the academia and the mediatic class is not prepared to fight and to understand, to listen to what a growing majority, in fact, of people are saying in this respect. Why? The political class is concerned that Muslims now are turning into a large part of the vote. And if they antagonize the Muslim vote, they will lose elections.
And this is true not just in France, I believe, in that even where the vote may not give rise to a dominant party, it may affect coalition governments in parliamentary systems.
5% of the vote is enough to make a difference, you see. All the more so in places where you don't have a 5% minority of Muslims, but places where Muslims amount already to something like 20 or 30 or even 50% of the local population. Various places all over Europe, including Barcelona, where you had the terrible terrorist attacks.
And you know, in connection with that Barcelona attack, Charlie Hebdo, the sort of satirical magazine that came to everyone's attention when it was subjected to a jihadist attack a few years back, Michel Garfinkel, there in Paris, has actually come out and put on its cover another cartoon deriding as a religion of peace those who perpetrated the attack in Barcelona. Does this translate, do you think, into a break in that mediatic elite, as you call it, that might portend that there's a stiffening of spine and resolve on the part of the elites in France?
First of all, Charlie Hebdo is simply going on with its nasty but courageous stand. You know, it can make fun of everything, including Islam as the religion of peace. They made a cover story calling Islam the religion of eternal peace. You know, I must say that many French papers or magazines have been comparatively more courageous over the past 2 years than they used to be before. The question of Islam and Islamization is discussed in many French papers. It's discussed at least in the recent press. But again, the political class is shy for political reasons, but they are also shy for another reason, which is that they simply are afraid of the consequences of any critical stand against Islam or Islamism in terms of public security.
Yeah, violence. This ultimately is the problem. Michelle, we are over time. I'm afraid we've got to go, but I want to thank you for your courage and that of Valeur Actuelle and, of course, the Jean-Jacques Rousseau Institute in speaking out on these matters, despite the dangers, despite the political incorrectness of it, as they say. We are always grateful to you for your visits with us, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. We'll talk a bit more about this freedom of speech business and much more with Diana West right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with the magnificent Diana West, a blogger par excellence these days, longtime syndicated columnist. You can find her writings at dianawest.net and often at the Daily Caller. She is also the author of two best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. It's always a pleasure to have her with us. Diana, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Frank. It's wonderful to be with you.
We've been talking throughout the program about this problem of hate speech restrictions, Diana, and you've been following closely how that's developed in Europe and in Canada, I think. And I'm interested in your thoughts as to whether those are canaries in the mineshaft, I guess you might say, about what's in the offing for us here if we're not careful.
Yes, well, I think we haven't been careful, and I think we're already seeing how it will go down. In Europe, you see actual enforcement of laws designed to penalize people for their speech. Here, we are not exactly at that legislative point because of the First Amendment, but I would argue that the First Amendment has essentially been suspended for many citizens, according to the local whim of government, which has aligned with leftists and thugs, police, which are standing down and effectively cowing people into not daring to enter the public square with political opinions that they are fearful will be shut down.
Or simply preventing them from doing so through Google and Facebook and Twitter and so on.
That's the other piece of it, yes. There's the physical violence and then the coercion of the workplace and Google and the penalization.
Shaming, all the rest of it, yeah. A frightening prospect and one that we must resist. I hope now that Congress is back, this will be on their agenda and that constructive action will be taken, not, unfortunately, more of the sort of thing that we saw in the Senate a few months back, where they adopted a resolution that seems to be very much of a mind with what's happening in Europe now and restricting freedom of speech. I'm disheartened by a poll by Rasmussen recently that indicated that something like 85% of the American people polled were very much of the mind that we need to protect freedom of speech, even if it is offensive to others. Diana, one of the things that you've been offended by, I know, as have I, is the disconnect between Donald Trump's Make America Great agenda, his campaign, his successful run for the presidency, and the staffing of his administration. Talk a little bit about that, as it struck you bizarre, as it has me.
Yes, well, this has been a continuing bizarreness that we've both been observing. I think it goes back to a little known fact, which is that the man who seems to be in charge of all White House staffing is someone who comes right out of the establishment, suggested by former Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, moved along by Jared Kushner, and that would be Johnny DiStefano, who seems to have control, the gatekeeper, over the 4,000 White House jobs that are filled or being filled still. And this is someone right out of the establishment. We've seen this in the past where conservatives, outsiders come in and the establishment grabs the gate on staffing. We've never seen it to this extent. And right now we have a situation, we're getting reports of a White House that almost seems like a military encampment, whereby the Chief of Staff, General Kelly, has essentially shut the president down in terms of talking to people, talking to friends and allies and so on. And so you just wonder, of course, it is Donald Trump's choice at this point to function in this atmosphere. So again, the question marks go up, the perplexity continues, but it is a key determinant of the direction of this administration when the people around the president are not in favor and are actually against his agenda, and that's what we have.
One of the other generals, of course, in what you've described as a junta in the Trump White House is, of course, Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor to the president. There were two people who, among the many that he's brought in or retained in the NSC, some a fifth of the total number of personnel and many, many of the senior personnel in the National Security Council, are two brothers, Gilbert and Ili Bakhtiari. I'd be interested in your thoughts about these individuals, Dinah West. They are folks who were originally from Kosovo. They are now respectively sort of the senior director for defense policy at the National Security Council and the gatekeeper to H.R. McMaster's personal office. What's going on here?
Well, I wish I knew. I mean, just your description of this, again, gatekeeper situation, going to Kosovar immigrants is staggering in terms from a counterintelligence point of view, regardless of any of the details. It's just an amazing situation that I think speaks to the greater problem that we are having, which is that we have, for example, we have intelligence agencies that seem to function in terms of gathering intelligence on Americans. This has been the story of the past several years. They function in the dark, and they are picking up our communications, our being American citizens. On the other side of the plate, we have no concept of subversion, no domestic counterintelligence working in the sense of Congress, which used to do this, was very good at it in conducting domestic subversion investigations. Investigations to determine whether legislation needed to be considered and worked on to address various forms of infiltration. So this is something we are blind on. And so you describe a situation that I think anyone coming from, say, 1959 would look at and say, these people are out of their minds. We need to address this possible security threat.
It is indeed. And Dinah West, you've done such important work on these sorts of issues, of course, in most especially American Betrayal, the secret assault on our nation's character. And I commend that to our listeners with the greatest of enthusiasm. Let me ask you, in a related matter, you wonder where Congress is in all of this. There was a report in the Daily Caller last week, I believe, by Luke Rosiak, in which he described the ranking Democratic member of the House Intelligence Committee's Emerging Threats Subcommittee, playing video games with and being tutored by a Pakistani national who he was relying upon to use his IT administrative activities. And he's not alone, but this is a particularly sensitive slot occupied by Andre Carson. And I just wonder, how on earth would we expect people to be doing an adequate job looking for counterintelligence problems if they have this apparent sort of compromise?
Well, yes. I mean, this is exactly the kind of situation. And part of the tutoring, I understand, was in a foreign language.
Yes, to learn a foreign language, an unspecified foreign language, mind you.
But it's a joke, and yet it's not a joke because it's real life. And it's a situation where we can learn about these things, but the mechanism for checking it out, sifting it through, investigating it, doing something about it is broken. It's whether it's Congress, whether it's the Justice Department, the FBI, we have nobody minding the store on any number of these national security fronts. And that it's a terrible place for a citizen of a republic, putative republic, to be in, because we can learn these things, and thanks to the occasional good reporter like Luke Rosiak, and there are others, but this is not a trend in journalism in our time, we can learn these things and be shocked by them, and nothing happens, because the people in those places to do things, who are charged and sworn to do these things, are failing at their job and not upholding their oaths.
Yeah, indeed. The oath they swore to defend us against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Dinah West, we prize your contributions to our understanding of all these things greatly and look forward to our visit with you again next week. We look forward to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Frank. from the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.